Welcome back for the final hour of Issues Etc. Today, we're going to start out talking about the midterm elections. Of course, these are always interesting things. They're made more interesting in a two-term president's second term. They are made even more interesting by an ongoing war that many people who may not have said this 2 years ago are now saying is trying to keep the cap on a civil war. Gas prices have gone down, although they've been down a little bit lately. That might have something to do with the fact that summer is drawing to an end. But as things heat up in the Middle East, and they certainly aren't seeming to cool down there, those gas prices are expected to rise. So what will that mean for the midterm elections? We'll answer those questions here in this half hour of Issues Etc. Dr. Jeff Walls will join us then in about a half hour. Dr. David Stevens will join us to react to the president on Plan B and also on the latest news that's circulating about a different way of getting stem cells, perhaps without destroying human embryos. We invite your questions and your comments, as we always do, for Dr. Jeff Walls, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If you want to email us a question or a comment, that's fair, too. IssuesETC@KFUO.org. We'll get those questions and comments via the email here in the studio and pass them along to Dr. Jeff Walls. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He joins us to talk about the midterm elections. Pastor Dr. Walls, welcome.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be here.
Okay. If the Democrats can't win at least the House this time, do they even have a chance? Gas prices, the war seems to be going poorly. The president is very, very unpopular. Everyone's trying to jump off his short coattails as quickly as they can. If they can't turn it around here, can they ever turn it around?
Good question. There is certainly a strong anti-incumbency fervor in the country. We saw Joe Lieberman in Connecticut lose his primary as a Democrat. He's now running as an independent. Just yesterday, the governor of Alaska, Murkowski, lost his primary as a Republican gubernatorial candidate. So there certainly is a strong anti-incumbent pitch in the country. At the same time, though, I think the Democrats are going to run into two challenges in trying to win back the House this year, and they certainly could win back that House. First, redistricting, and that is the redrawing of congressional lines every 10 years, but it may be a little more frequent now. What both parties have done, especially in the last 10 or 12 years, has been to draw lines that insulate their own people from competitive races. So both the Democrats and the Republicans have created more what we might call safe districts. So that'll be one challenge the Democrats will have. Unlike 1994, and that was the cataclysmic year when Newt Gingrich, the Contract with America, brought in a Republican House, unlike that year, there are more safe districts this year, even given the times, for both Democrats and Republicans. So that'll certainly be one challenge. And I think a second challenge for the Democrats, I'm still waiting for the Democrats to come up with some kind of unified agenda for the country, like the Contract with America back in 94. What the Democrats, I think, are struggling with now is trying to put together something where many of their candidates can sign on to it. What should their issues be? Should it be an anti-war platform? Should it be railing against, as you said, high gas prices? Should it be jobs? Should it be health care? So I think unless and until the Democrats come out with some kind of, maybe not a contract, but some kind of a statement saying this or these are the principles or ideas on which we're going to run, it still could be a challenge for them to win back the House, even given, as you said, a number of factors in their favor.
What is the single biggest issue that will determine, in your opinion, how people are going to vote and whether or not there can be a shift in the House or the Senate in these midterm elections?
Yeah. It does seem that as you alluded to, Iraq is on the top of people's minds. We've had members of the House and Senate in recess now back in their districts, trying to take the pulse of their people, of their constituents. And while certainly gas prices are high on many people's list and other issues, Iraq does tend to be really the issue, the lightning rod issue that's attracting a lot of interest from constituents. And mostly, of course, constituents who are concerned about how the war is going. So that to me, unless we have some kind of a change in the dynamic of the war, that'll be the issue that I think both Democrats and Republicans will either be elected or lose on come November.
Is the war the biggest issue for the Republicans, too?
I think it certainly could be, yeah. I think what the Republicans are trying to do now is to position themselves to be tough on terror, to be tough on the war on terror, while suggesting perhaps we need to stay the course in Iraq, but with some changes in strategy or changes in tactics. I think most Republicans and certainly most candidates don't want to set any kind of timetable, don't want to remove themselves from that war. But at the same time, I think the people, even Republicans, are saying, give us a better sense of the plan, a better sense of the strategy and the tactics so that we can continue to have faith in that war effort.
What could President Bush do in the time remaining here between now and November that could help Republican senators or congressmen who are running for re-election and trying to hold their seats?
Well, one thing, and he has been doing this on occasion, is simply to go out and raise money for candidates. He is the president. He is in his second term, and people, especially Republicans, like to go and see the president. And that brings in significant campaign money for candidates, and the candidates clearly can use that money to their advantage. So that's one thing he can do. And I think, and he's done this lately as well, that he can remain firm in the war on terror and try and suggest that we are reevaluating some of the strategies, some of the tactics in Iraq. And as he said, it's a long war, and it's not a good idea necessarily to pull out now. But I think the people want to hear a little more of what the next steps or what some kind of benchmarks might be to determine our progress in Iraq.
Well, could he, in the vein of the last thing you just mentioned, could he send a strong signal and perhaps increase his party's chances in the midterm elections if he said, okay, the best way to signal that we're reevaluating is to change some leadership around, namely the man who seems to be one of his most unpopular aides in the war, and that is Rumsfeld.
Rumsfeld, right, yeah. And not only Democrats, but some Republicans have been calling for Defense Secretary Rumsfeld to step down. Again, Bush tends to be kind of conflicted on this. One noteworthy, trademark of the Bush presidency, and it can be a very good thing in many ways, has been his loyalty to the people he's brought into his team. He hasn't let too many of his cabinet members go, and he tends to be very loyal to his own people. And that can be, again, a very good thing to carry out your plans and visions. So on the other hand, I think you're right. Changing something like Defense Secretary could be a signal to the public and to some of the members of Congress that here's a president who realizes that perhaps a change in personnel, just a fresh face, could be what's needed to inject a little more faith into the war effort. Now, the downside of that, of course, is Bush could be accused of trying to make this change at the 11th hour for electoral purposes, and that would be the downside to that kind of a policy. But, certainly that's a possibility. At this relatively late date, it's probably unlikely that he would make that move, although it certainly could be a boon to not only his Iraq policy, but to some members of Congress as well.
Let's talk about a related issue to the war. Of course, it all seems to be related in some way, Professor Walz, but gas prices. I'll tell you what, speaking as simply a citizen and a voter with absolutely no expertise in economics, but just a guy who drives every day and commutes every day, it's made a believer out of me in the fact that our energy policy is now a national security issue for me. And I'm thinking to myself this morning, even though they're not so bad now, if they went up, it could really, really hurt the entire economy in a way that would take decades to recover from. Am I, at least from your way of looking at the public's opinion, am I just a kook who's worried about something that some sort of doomsday scenario?
No, certainly not. You're right. As prices rise, and I think it's significant that the folks in the, I'd say, I guess, the middle to upper middle class feel some of the pinch. So certainly people in the lower ladders of economic worth are really feeling the pinch. And certainly if prices would shoot up for whatever reason, perhaps Alaskan kind of malfunction in getting the oil here, or Middle East uncertainty, whatever it is, that could have a significant impact nationally on the economy. And I think you're certainly right that as we consume so much fuel, as we consume so much oil, in essence, we're fomenting to a point at least some of this war on terror, because many of these regimes in the Middle East rely upon oil for their income. And at this point, clearly with the demand for oil, the demand for fuel, they're sitting pretty. There's no pressure on some of these regimes, these repressive regimes, to reform because they have this oil money flowing in. So one thing we certainly need to do now and in the long term for national security is to push much harder for alternate forms of fuel, for hybrid engines, hybrid vehicles, things like that. One idea that I don't think we'll ever see the light of day, but some have suggested, Thomas Friedman, for example, is we should raise the price of gas another dollar or so, which would have a significant impact, or could, on our consumption. And if consumption goes down, some of these Middle East regimes which rely so much on oil would have to reform internally. Don't know if that'll happen, but certainly the impact of higher gas prices nationally and from a security perspective are very significant.
I think what worries most people about gas prices is not where they're at now, but where they may go in the future. And I think they're even worried about a temporary but heavy spike in those prices that could set the dominoes tumbling a little bit. And even though the prices may normalize again at some point, one big spike could really hurt us for a long time.
It could, and I'm not an economist either, but as the economists and analysts have said, the more people put into gasoline, the more of your income that you set aside for transportation, then, of course, unless you get a big raise every year, the less money there'll be for other things, the less money there'll be for other purchases. House purchases, we've seen the housing market, if not plummet, certainly take a hit in several areas. And there are many reasons for that, but one reason is that people have less money with which to buy a house or to move to a different house. And so, yes, as more of this income is going toward fuel, toward transportation, less money is going to be going toward other parts of the economy, and that's going to have a bit of a trickle-down effect in that way.
We're talking about the midterm elections and all of the issues that surround them. Dr. Jeff Walz is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. You can call us with a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Or you can email us at issuesetc@kfuo.org. How big of an issue do you think illegal immigration is going to be in the midterm elections, Dr. Walz?
It's becoming a more significant issue, especially in the wake of failed attempts to get some kind of a bill passed. And what was proposed was in the Senate a bill that would essentially provide a tough enforcement mechanism with a mechanism to bring more immigrants, illegal immigrants, into legal status over time, or at least in a guest worker program, whereas the House version was much more focused only on enforcement measures. We haven't seen any kind of an agreement to get both of those bills into one form, and so it's really, I'd say, doubtful that we'd get any bill to the president's desk before the election. Now, what the Republicans have tried to do now is they've held these listening sessions in some parts of the country on the issue. And I think what they're trying to suggest is by taking a kind of get-tough approach, by at least, for example, putting up a fence and trying to keep more illegal immigrants initially out of the country, that's the way to take a first stab at the issue or first stab at the problem. So in some senses, I think that might play well with some constituents who are concerned, as many Americans are, about the number of illegal immigrants coming in. On the other hand, without a bill passed, the Democrats might be able to say, well, you know, the Republicans did not deliver on this issue. We were thinking we might get a bill passed, we might get some action, and look, there's nothing here. There's not an accomplishment to be seen. So if there's not a bill passed, I think you'll see the politics of it play out in that way.
Iran is also, of course, on everyone's mind. And again, like gas prices, not so much what's happening now, but what might happen in the near future. Do you think that the Iranian situation, as it relates to Iraq, as it relates to Israel, as it relates to Hezbollah, all of those things, the tentacles go out quite far. Do you think that's going to have a bearing on the midterm elections, or is that more an issue that's going to really tip things in 2008 at a presidential election?
Yeah, I think you're right, Todd. I don't see, for at least the typical or average voter, Iran, Hezbollah, some of the Middle East conflict playing a very significant role, especially with the at least fragile ceasefire and with the cessation, some of the hostilities. I don't see that being the hot-button issue that in Iraq certainly could be. And I also don't see a lot of people necessarily connecting the dots between, say, Iraq and Hezbollah and Iran, although certainly the dots are to be connected. But as an election issue, generally people will look at the big-picture issues, especially in a midterm election. Now, this one could be different. But in a midterm election, generally, the turnout is significantly lower than a presidential election, around roughly, say, a third to 40% of eligible voters versus maybe half in a presidential election. We could see some Iran effect in the vote, but I would think it would be fairly negligible.
What about the general economy? We've talked about gas prices and a couple issues related to it, but the general economy. And here again, I'll just speak as someone who just watches these things outside my kitchen window. Literally, I watch a subdivision being built outside my kitchen window. Houses that are in, you know, price ranges of probably upwards of $300,000. They're not selling as briskly as they were 5 years ago. And, of course, the interest rates are higher. And apparently consumer confidence, while inflation is not a big deal, consumer confidence is not what it used to be either. What's that going to mean in a couple of months when we go to the polls?
Yeah, that is kind of an interesting contrast, because you're right. On the one hand, if you look at kind of the big picture economic indicators, the inflation, if you look at productivity, GDP, gross domestic product, how productive we are as a country, those numbers are actually pretty good by historical standards. You know, interest rates have gone up a little bit, but they're still, again, pretty good by historic rates. But there does seem to be a disconnect between kind of this overall general good economic picture and then what we see at the individual or the grassroots or the individual level, where people, as you said, are paying more for gas. People are not necessarily feeling confident enough to make that home purchase or to shift residences necessarily unless they have to. Health care is still taking a significant bite out of people's wallets. Pensions are a concern. So I think you add those issues up, and to the typical voter, those are troubling issues. Those are very troubling issues, and again, issues that not necessarily can be addressed by the party in power. Some of these issues are out of their realm. But still certainly at the top of some people's voting agendas.
Let's say, for the sake of argument, coming back to where we began, Professor Walz, if the Democratic Party is able to win back at least the House by a comfortable margin, and perhaps even the Senate, what will that mean for the last 2 years of George W. Bush's administration?
I think it would hold the potential of getting a bit more done. The challenge now, and I guess I don't want to sound too pessimistic, but unless there's a clear signal from the country that the country would like the Republicans to move in a certain direction. So in other words, unless the Republicans do very well in the House and the Senate, then I sense the last 2 years of the Bush administration, the quote-unquote lame duck years, probably will not foment very much activity or very much progress on a number of fronts. And if the number of seats between the two parties, whether the Republicans or the Democrats, win the House and the Senate, then again you're going to have a very difficult situation of trying to get much done. And potentially then you could have the moderates of both parties playing potentially a more productive and proactive role in trying to negotiate solutions to some of these issues. But, if Democrats were to win, let's say hypothetically, that would just, I think, lead to probably absolute stalemate. I don't see the Democrats and the Republicans, on many issues at least, coming to the table and moving toward constructive decisions.
Okay, then a quick final question on the 2008 presidential elections. Name the top three Democratic and Republican candidates as you might pick them out for 2008. Presidential candidates,
yeah,
I would
yeah,
say.
Yeah, yeah. From a Republican perspective, John McCain seems to certainly be the front runner right now. He's done a very effective job of working and being seen with President Bush. Some of the conservative base has concerns about him, but he's certainly very strong. George Allen, senator from Virginia, also is a possibility. Mitt Romney from Massachusetts, another possibility. On the Democratic side, certainly it's many people have said, and I probably agree, Hillary Clinton's to win or lose at this point. Howard Dean might come back. It's unclear about that. John Edwards, who ran as VP, I think will be viable. And kind of a dark horse candidate, although one colleague said it'll never happen, he told me today, but Al Gore is lurking out there as well as a possibility. So those are at least couple three on each side.
I noticed that the only governor that you mentioned, if I'm not mistaken, is Mitt Romney.
Correct, right.
All right, so we're really, in your opinion, the names that are emerging now really are coming from within Washington.
Yeah, I think so. There is Mark Warner, the former governor of Virginia, who's kind of a new, I guess, in some ways a Clintonian Democrat, a pro-business kind of Democrat. And so he'd be, I guess, considered gubernatorial material. He's another possibility.
Dr. Jeff Walls is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. It's been a pleasure talking with you. It always is. Thanks for being our guest.
You too, Todd. Thank you very much.
All right, last half hour of the program is going to be devoted to two issues. One is, and I heard about this yesterday and could hardly believe my ears, and then I heard about it again today, and we thought, well, we have to have Dr. Stevens from the Christian Medical Association on to answer this. They're saying, at least one guy is saying, a researcher is saying, he's found a way with a fairly high success rate, he says, those things are relative, of getting stem cells without destroying a human embryo. Now, that would, if it were true, perhaps solve the whole ethical problem of embryonic stem cells. But do ethical problems remain? We'll find out what it is on the other side with Dr. David Stevens. We'll also talk about the morning after pill and President Bush.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Deaconess Pam Nielsen, senior editor at Concordia Publishing House, on the Christ-centered cross focus of Growing in Christ, the new Sunday school curriculum from Concordia Publishing House.
We've been very intentional in one, teaching the scriptures. We are concerned about Bible literacy. Pastors tell us they get kids in confirmation that they don't know any of the Bible stories, they don't know any of the Bible people. So we're trying to teach the Bible stories, the who, what, where, and when. But we're teaching them in the context of Christ. And every story, every week, be it Old or New Testament, connects to Christ as the Savior.
For more information about Growing in Christ, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or find the Growing in Christ logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. It's a Christ-centered, cross-focused Sunday school curriculum, Growing in Christ.
Adam, now he did not evolve?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the children's rhyme book, A is for Adam. Well, Ken, how could anyone get the idea that Adam evolved from reading the creation account in the book of Genesis?
Well, Mark, because many Christians have been indoctrinated to believe in evolution, some have tried to somehow fit molecules to man evolution with the Bible's account of creation. Now, this is called theistic evolution. These people say God must have taken an ape and made a soul for it to become a man. But in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, we read, "And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground." Now, I've heard some Christians say, well, the dust must represent the ape that God used to form the man. Well, let's be consistent here and read what God said to Adam in Genesis chapter 3, verse 9, after sin. "In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return unto the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and unto dust you shall return." If the dust in chapter 2 means an ape, then what sort of ape did Adam return to when he died? No, this is nonsense. Adam didn't evolve. He was created directly from dust, just as it states in Genesis.
A question that we're often asked at our ministry relates to one of Adam's children, Cain. And it was a question also posed at the Scopes trial. Where did Cain find his wife? Ken Ham has actually written a booklet on that intriguing question, and you can read it on our website, AnswersRadio.com. The free booklet is available at AnswersRadio.com.
Well, I'm glad Jesus didn't feel that way about you.
Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief, responding to the idea that the AIDS crisis is self-inflicted and Christians need not respond in love.
Look, you reap what you sow. You're a sinner. You're damned to hell. Go rot. That's not Jesus. And the Bible doesn't tell us, Jesus says, you made your bed, now lie in it. I'm not going to help. So, it's an impossible response for a Christian, even though we know that actions have consequences. But consequences, those consequences don't kill mercy and don't kill a proclamation of the law in order to bring the gospel.
Find LCMS World Relief at our homepage, issuesetc.org, Christ-centered, cross-focused, love for the neighbor.
AM 850 KFUO is grateful for those of you who support our radio ministry. Today, we say thank you to Joe and Joan Harwell of Clayton, Missouri, Ken and Betty Leeshight of Baldwin, Missouri, and Lee and Joe Enders of St. Louis, Missouri. Your support helps make the programming on AM 850 KFUO possible.
Are worried that your choice of FDA commissioner will approve over-the-counter sales of Plan B, a pill that they say essentially can cause early-term abortions. Do you stand by this choice, and how do you feel about Plan B in general?
I believe that Plan B ought to require a prescription for minors. That's what I believe, and I support Andy's decision.
President George W. Bush earlier this week in a press conference answering a question about the FDA and the so-called morning after pill Plan B, emergency contraceptive. He pretty much is happy with what the FDA is planning on doing by way of compromise, and as long as it requires a prescription for people who are under 18. We're going to be talking about that and a new report that claims to be able to get stem cells from embryos without destroying the embryos. Dr. David Stevens joins us for this last half hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. He'll join us here in just a moment. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for August is called Luther's World of Thought. Now, you can read Luther from cover to cover of all his many works and get a pretty good idea what he was thinking. But if you examine Luther's thought outside the context of the world in which he lived, the world in which he was raised and educated, in which he did his work as a reformer and a thinker, you really are, well, you're pulling Luther out of context. That's what this book, Luther's World of Thought, attempts to do, is put Luther in his context and therefore have a better understanding of Luther's thought by understanding the world of thought where he did his thinking. The book is $29.99 plus shipping and handling. You can find out more about this book by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or you can also browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look for Luther's World of Thought there at issuesetc.org. Oh, and by the way, be sure to tune in tonight at 8 for the rebroadcast to today's first hour. We're going to discuss the Lord, the cup of the Lord, and the cup of demons, that passage there in 1 Corinthians. And we'll also talk with Dr. Peter Scare of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, about St. Bartholomew, also known as Nathaniel. That's tonight from 8 to 9 here on AM 850 KFUO. Dr. David Stevens is a regular guest. He's executive director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. Dr. Stevens, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Great to be with you, Todd.
Your general reaction to the president earlier this week in the press conference, question right at the very end, and we heard it just a moment ago, where he said he's fine with the FDA's plan to offer, or at least the stated plan, to offer the morning after pill over the counter to women over 18 and by prescription to women under 18.
Well, I think he's misguided in his decision. The FDA has been under tremendous political pressure, as well as he has, to make this over-the-counter, as it's called, Plan B, or the morning-after pill, available. And why are we so concerned about it? Well, I think there's a number of reasons. As Christians, first of all, we're concerned about it morally and biblically. We know that about 45% of the time when a woman takes this around the time of ovulation, it doesn't prevent ovulation, it actually prevents the implantation of a developing human being. If the woman has not ovulated, if the egg hasn't come out of her ovary, then it prevents that. But if she already has, she gets pregnant, and then it makes it impossible for that embryo to implant in the uterus. It kills a human being. And that's an issue of informed consent, Todd, because on the packaging it says very boldly that's available across the counter when it gets there, this is not an abortifacient. It doesn't cause abortions. And the reason it can say that is because the American College of OBGYN changed the definition of pregnancy a few years ago, saying you're not pregnant until implantation takes place. So since implantation doesn't take place, it's not an abortion. Well, the big issue for women is this killed one of my children, and 50% of women in the United States are concerned about that.
Now, I'm wondering, I guess I just come out and say it, why the president would, if he understands what Plan B is really all about and the concerns of organizations like yours, concerns like people like me and you, why he would be happy with the FDA's compromise?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think there definitely is a compromise, because they were going to make this available to 13-year-olds, and now it's only 18-year-olds. But with this political pressure, you know, I don't understand. After all the years of watching Washington, I don't pretend to try to understand it. But this is a big issue. It's bad health care policy, Todd, is the rest of it, because not only is this a moral issue, the most common reason that teenagers, college-age girls, come to see a physician is for contraception. So if you're buying this over the counter, you don't go see the doctor. That means you don't get routine health screening or physical examination. You don't get sexual counseling. You don't get screening for sexually transmitted diseases. It disrupts that relationship, which is going to put a lot of young women at risk. And, of course, one of the epidemics we're having in this country right now is infertility due to sexually transmitted diseases gotten at a young age due to sexual promiscuity.
With the president's imprimatur, or at least what it sounds like is his approval, is the FDA compromise on Plan B a done deal?
Maybe and maybe not. One of the things that some of the Christian legal groups are looking at, like Christian Legal Society, is that does the Congress act that authorizes the FDA allow them to do a dual-use licensure? What do I mean by that? The same drug and the same dose is available for under 18 by prescription and over 18 without prescription. The law seems to say you can be one or the other, but you can't be both. And so there may be a legal challenge which could hold up the implementation of their decision.
So that's really a question of what legal authority the FDA has when it comes to approving drugs for over-the-counter sale or restricting them to prescription sales.
That's correct. And can you do both when it's the same dose? We know you can. I mean, it's very clear that you can do it if there's a lesser dose. You have a over-the-counter Claritin dose and you have a physician-prescribed larger dose. But it's the same drug, so that raises some interesting legal issues that I'm sure will get sorted out in court.
We were talking with the new president of Concerned Women for America not too long ago, And she had said her main concern about Plan B, well, one of her big concerns about Plan B was, look, Plan B is at a higher dose, basically the same drug as a prescription
birth control pill.
Thank you. And she said it just doesn't make any sense to say, let's have a greater dose, and really a much, much greater dose, offered over the counter to anyone, while we still say that the prescription birth control pill will require a prescription. Now, I puzzled over this and talked about it with our audience, and then I heard on the radio someone's explanation. Tell me if it holds any water. They said, well, it has to do with what the drug's going to be used for. The Plan B, the higher dose, which would have no prescription attached to it, is not expected to be used on a daily basis by women. Therefore, it's not going to be as dangerous as, say, the long-term possible side effects of the birth control pill. Does that explanation hold much water for you?
That's actually probably true. But the other side of the coin we need to look at is there are no restrictions on women using this as their primary form of birth control. In other words, every time I have unprotected intercourse, I take this pill. If they do that, what is the long-term effect of using these higher doses multiple times? Nobody knows. No study has been done that shows what the effect of that is in women if they use it two or three times a month for 5 or 10 years. And there may be a very deleterious effect, because we know birth control pills have risk involved for heart disease and stroke and all sorts of things. And so in lesser doses over a longer period of time, what is larger doses over not every day but frequently going to do? Nobody knows. It hadn't been studied.
All right. You answer this one for me then, too. What is to stop, if the compromise, the FDA compromise on Plan B goes through, Dr. Stevens, what is to stop a 24-year-old woman from walking in and buying Plan B over-the-counter, turning around, and because it is a non-prescription drug, giving it to a minor? There's nothing illegal about that, because non-prescription drugs, I can give my kid NyQuil, I can buy it over-the-counter. What's to stop that from happening?
Nothing, and even a greater concern than that, to me as a dad, is some 18-year-old boy buying it and giving it to my 14-year-old daughter to pressure her into having sex with him, or some sexual predator using this to cover his tracks. There is no way to police this. There's nothing in the FDA regulations that requires anything. All they say is to bar pharmaceuticals. Hey, if you hear reports of this being abused, you need to let us know. Well, they have no incentive to do that. This is going to sell for $30 to $40 a dose. It costs pennies to make this pill. This is high profit for a pharmaceutical company that's been, in the midst of RU-486 and a lot of other things, and they have no desire to police themselves. So I think it's a joke to think that we're going to find out how well this works by trying it out. Once it's out, the cat's out of the bag, it's going to be very difficult to put it back in.
We're talking with Dr. David Stevens, the executive director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association based in Bristol, Tennessee, about both Plan B and now the subject that perked my ears up a couple days ago when it first was reported, at least first time I heard it reported, Dr. Stevens, and that has to do with an apparent breakthrough in the ability to harvest stem cells from living human embryos without destroying the embryo in the process. What do you know about this? Can you explain what this technique is and what's been claimed, and then does it remove all ethical concerns?
What scientists have done is use a technique that is now used in some in vitro fertilization clinics called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. What they're doing is taking an embryo that has grown to about the 8 to 10 cell stage and actually making a little slit in the envelope and pulling a cell outside of that embryo. That's done now for genetic testing. And what they're doing is testing these embryos to see if they carry some genetic disease before deciding whether they're going to implant it or not. Essentially a form of eugenics, deciding who lives or dies based upon a genetic characteristic. And with some new technology that just happened in the last 2 or 3 months, we're going to be able to test for thousands of conditions. So you could decide whether, this embryo has a 20% chance of getting ovarian cancer when she's 40. I don't want to implant that one. And so for any kind of characteristic, or even for colors of eyes or color of hair or whatever, what they're touting is, well, we don't destroy the embryo, so the embryo still can be implanted. So this is a way to get embryonic stem cells and start a culture from that one cell without destroying the embryo. Well, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on here, and I think people need to realize it. What's not being said is at this stage of development, those cells are what we call totipotent. What's that mean? That means each cell in that embryo has the capability of forming a human being. That's when natural identical twinning takes place. The embryo has one or more cells break off, and you have identical twins and a multiple pregnancy. So what actually is going on is artificial twinning. The first twin, the one that the cell was taken from, gets to live because it's implanted. The second twin is used to form an embryonic stem cell culture and is destroyed. So you really have not dealt with the moral issue.
Now, I'm also concerned, apart from that very, that's the threshold moral issue.
Right.
Are you really actually, in fact, bypassing the ethical problem of destroying a human embryo? And it sounds like you're saying, not really. The other one is this. Even if that weren't the case, are there any risks to removing, say, one cell from an 8-cell embryo?
Bottom line is nobody knows. The studies have not been done long-term to see the impact at birth or long-term in the development of that child. There are some indications to raise concerns. We're now seeing some increased risk for children that are born through just regular in vitro fertilization. Lower birth weights, increasing miscarriage, some development concerns. And these are children that have not, you know, had part of their corpus, so to say, removed, one of their cells taken out. And bottom line is nobody knows. One of the scientific principles is that we never do research on someone that can harm them unless there is a particular benefit to that person. In other words, I'm researching diabetes. I can find the cure and cure your diabetes. You got to remember, these embryos are just being picked out to be research guinea pigs, and they may be harmed in the process, and that's really unethical.
So in other words, if there's no advantage to the subject,
right,
then the researcher cannot ethically say, I will do harm without any attendant advantage.
Right, no potential benefit for this this patient. And I know that I'm putting them at a significant risk.
This is what Dr. William Hurlbut, he's been a guest on this program several times, and he's head of the President's Council on Bioethics, a member of the President's Council on Bioethics. He says to pluck one cell out is to take something out of the original embryo. What is the concern that Dr. Hurlbut is expressing here?
I think he's essentially saying what I'm saying. I know Bill, and we would share that concern. What, in fact, the President's Council on Bioethics issued a statement stating exactly that, that it's unethical to put embryos at risk for research that has no benefit for them, but just to satisfy the curiosity of scientists. I think the other thing we need to point out here, though, is this, Todd, is that, you know, we're not getting the success with embryonic stem cells that everybody had been predicting. In fact, there was an article in the New York Times just last week kind of finally fessing up, saying scientists are saying, well, you know, it may be 10 or 20 years. There's more interest in this and kind of doing basic science research. We're not going to see these cures right away. Sorry, we kind of promised that, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. And so they're already beginning to backtrack. And we know, if you look at the science, that where we're seeing successes is with adult stem cells from umbilical cord, from the bone marrow, and those areas. And there are now close to 70 different diseases that are being treated. Studies going on at Harvard, Yale, using bone marrow stem cells and infusing them directly into the heart post-heart attack to get the heart muscle to rebuild itself where it's been damaged, and many more things than that. And so shouldn't we be putting our money and effort into ethical research without a risk to embryos? And that's where we're getting the success, because all of us want cures, not something 20 years down the road, but something a few months to a few years down the road.
Given the fact that there are still ethical concerns here, is it at least heartening for you that researchers are attempting to find ways to to procure stem cells, albeit from embryos, without harming embryos?
I think that's ethically laudable as long as they don't do harm at the same time. Can we learn things from embryonic stem cells? Absolutely. I mean, but what's happened, and one of the reasons people need to understand that scientists are so excited about this, is that it gives them the opportunity to do destructive research. You always learn more when you don't have to worry about the subject surviving. And this is the first time in modern science in the U.S. that that's possible on a human being, and that's what's happening with these embryos. And secondly, embryonic stem cells let you study development of tissues in the body, which you can learn from. It lets you study disease states. Why does somebody get diabetes? Why does this disease run in their families? Those type of things. Not cures, but basic science will help us understand disease. The trouble is we cannot allow the destruction of a human being, even for laudable goals, because once you cross that barrier, there's no logical place to draw the line. Do we sacrifice one of our children if it can save 100 people, or it saves 500 people or 1,000 people? I mean, what would you think was adequate salvage of people's lives to donate your son or daughter to science? Well, you'd think there's no amount of help that I could give to someone else that would allow me to do that. But that's what's happening with these embryos. Somebody's daughter or son is being destroyed for scientific purposes.
This was the reaction of the Bush administration to the news that came out about advanced cell technology, the story we're talking about here. Quote, any use of human embryos for research purposes raises serious ethical concerns. This technique does not resolve all those concerns. The president is hopeful that with time, scientists can find ways of driving those cells like those now derived from human embryos, but without the need for using embryos. Is that a satisfying reaction at this stage, as far as you're concerned, Dr. Stevens?
It is, and I think that's a good statement. The Dickey Amendment, which is in the Health and Human Services Act, says very clearly that no embryo can be used for research purposes unless it's actually going to benefit that embryo. And not just embryos in general, but that embryo. And that's what the president has stuck to, and I think it's a good law.
Now, we mentioned Dr. Hurlbut before, and he has tentatively suggested on this program and, of course, elsewhere, that there might be yet another way of doing this. He calls it altered nuclear transfer as opposed to somatic cell nuclear transfer. And I want to know if you know anything about this and if you have any concerns about that proposed technique.
Yeah, I've talked to him extensively about this, and I think it's perfectly all right to try this technique in animal models, and that's where he's going with it, to see how well it works. I think there's still some questions that he and I both would have about the technique.
What exactly is being proposed here, let's say, in animal models?
What's being proposed is to actually alter the DNA of the cell and let it begin to develop. In other words, it's not cloning, but it's very similar to cloning, which is difficult for people to understand. And then essentially making an entity that cannot continue to develop. The big moral question is this a human being that has a genetic time bomb, or is this not a human being and just tissue that's been developed? And it's really going to take some studies to figure that out. And place to do that is in animal studies. And then if it's applicable to human beings, that'd be wonderful. It would give a source of embryonic stem cells without the ethical concerns that all of us have.
So, in other words, this is as yet undetermined. ANT, altered nuclear transfer. It's undetermined as to where that falls on the ethical boundary.
I think it holds some hope, and I think it should be explored. And a lot of other pro-life groups think it should be as well. And Bill's got a wonderful pro-life heart, and he's a tremendous scientist, highly respected, and realizes the constraints, the moral constraints that should be around medicine. He's trying to find a way to not cross those boundaries, at the same time meet the needs of scientists who want to do basic research on embryonic stem cells.
What's the bottom line for whether it is ANT, SCNT, this new process that has been announced as of this week. What's the bottom line when it comes to embryonic stem cell research for you, Dr. Stevens?
You cannot destroy the embryo. You cannot harm the embryo or potentially harm the embryo unless you're doing something to particularly benefit it. This is a human being. It's created by God. You and each one of us was once an embryo, and if somebody destroyed us, we wouldn't be having this conversation today or be listening to the radio. God himself became an embryo and sanctified every stage of human development, and therefore we need to protect life at all its stages because he sees the value of it.
Dr. David Stevens is Executive Director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for enlightening us here. The website address for the Christian Medical and Dental Association is cmdahome.org, cmdahome.org. Dr. Stevens, thank you very much for being our guest.
Great to be with you, Todd.
Folks, let's look for a moment, if you would, at the topics that we've covered here today on Issues, Etc. so far in just 3 short hours. We started out, we talked about the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. We discussed St. Bartholomew, Nathaniel. We talked about Time Magazine's story on Christianity in China. And that was just halfway through the program. We talked about the idols that are so common in America. We talked about the midterm elections and all the issues that surround them. And in this last half hour alone, we talked about both Plan B and embryonic stem cell research, two of the top news stories on the life issue this week. Now, one of the strengths of Issues, Etc. is the wide variety of issues that we deal with, and we deal with them in a very timely way, I think you could say. Now, if you've benefited from this outreach, consider partnering with us by joining our Issues, Etc. Reformation Club this weekend. There are all kinds of benefits of becoming an Issues, Etc. confessor, apologist, or reformer. Premiums like monthly tapes and books and transcripts. If you want more information on the Issues, Etc. Reformation Club, all you need to do is go to our website, issuesetc.org. Go there tonight, issuesetc.org, and look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Right there, you're going to find a link to more information on the Issues, Etc. Reformation Club. The website address again, issuesetc.org. Tomorrow on the program, a fascinating, very interesting 2-hour conversation with Dr. Reed Lessing on rapture theology. Then Sunday on the program, we're going to discuss predestination, one of the touchiest issues in theology, I imagine. Predestination and election. Does God choose some to go to heaven and others to go to hell? Dr. Ken Sherb of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri will be our guest. Then, and that's Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Then Monday on the program, how to stay Christian and go to college at the same time. Can the two be done? How many people enter college as Christians and enter and leave as either something else or as atheists? Pastor Mark Zill will join us Monday to talk about that. Tune in tonight at 8 for the rebroadcast of today's first hour of Issues, Etc. That's from 8 to 9 here on AM 850 KFUO. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.